here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Game over, man.
Good
Game
morning, over. Geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, everybody on board. We're going to start the show. It is, what day is today? Is it? It's Tuesday, Kalo says. Tuesday. Mark Riley still out of town in England. Probably coming back today, I'm thinking. Wayne Gilman insisted that he was in New Jersey, but we have proof that he wasn't. He was actually still in England. He will be back tomorrow morning. Our guest host today in studio is Mr. Anthony LaPay from the Guerrilla News Network. Good morning, sir.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Good, man. It's nice to have you on. Today, we're going to have some good guests. We've got former Navy lawyer John Hudson discussing why he and a growing number of military law experts are opposing the confirmation of Alberto Gonzalez for Attorney General. And later in the show, John Howard Kunstler discusses peak oil and what happens after the oil runs out. He's best known for his series on suburbia, the book The Geography of Nowhere and Home from Nowhere and The City in the Mind. A very interesting guy. But Anthony, let me ask you some questions, because a lot of people don't know about Guerrilla News Network. I think a lot of people do who listen to this show, but I remember when I first came upon it, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I've got to put this on my favorites list, because it was all about that. I read the first time I got hip to it was about the story about the dude that sued Coca-Cola.
Right.
Yeah. What is Guerrilla News Network? How did it start, and where how did it come about?
Well, GNN, it was, for years, a scrappy organization. Really, just four of us started in the year 2000 with the idea of trying to reach people who were totally disaffected by traditional news sources, whether that's young people, you know, were sitting around playing PlayStation all day, mm-hmm. or older people who just didn't trust Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather. So we came up with this thing called the news video, which is a mix between a short documentary and a music video. We hooked up a lot of recording artists, and we did some hard-hitting short videos about important global stories, like the diamond trade in Sierra Leone, and other things like the CIA.
So it was sort of like that was your gimmick.
That was the hook.
Right.
And then where I come in, I've come from more of a journalism background, and I edit our website where we have investigative articles about all sorts of topics that the mainstream media is sort of missing. And we've expanded since then to now we have actually, it's more of a web community where users can come and set up blogs, their own homepages, write blogs. We have a really active forum. And it was actually a big year for us in 2004. We did a book called True Lies.
Sure.
We did a feature documentary called Battleground, 21 Days on the Empire's Edge, which my partner Stephen Marshall and I shot in Iraq. But we're probably best known, and the listeners out there probably know us most for the music video collaboration we did with Eminem for Mosh.
Okay, and you know I've gotten word from the inside, mainly you on breaks, and there's going to be a big exciting new music video
we're working with another big artist on hopefully some another music video that hopefully will be even more controversial.
So look, you know, you were talking to me, you know, before we came on the show about some conspiracy theories, and you know, it's very interesting to me because I am somewhat a little bit furious in terms of it seems to that the Republicans have actually successfully co-opted President Clinton. I mean, how the hell does that happen? I'm watching TV, George Bush, the president now, gets on TV with his father, George Bush Sr., and Bill Clinton sitting there without a look of hate on his face. They're all coming together to help tsunami victims. Fine, but why the hell can Bill Clinton just do it by himself? I mean, didn't these guys put him through enough crap over 10 years that he's got to stand there acting like nothing's wrong with these two dummies? I couldn't believe it.
Well, if you delve into the dark regions of the internet, like I am wont to do, doesn't come as a surprise. Many conspiracy theorists, and they have a lot of evidence to support it, believe that there's been a nexus between the Clintons and the Bushes that goes back to the 80s.
Besides some of his political stance.
Right. Clinton was the governor of Arkansas at the same time the whole Iran-Contra thing was going in Central America. And many people, including a former DEA agent who told me this personally, believe that some of those drugs that were being used to finance the Contras, which was came out in the Kerry Commission hearings, and this was well known that this was going on, were being flown into Mena, Arkansas, where there was a military base there, and that Clinton was somehow involved.
Right, so it's sort of this weird, you know, dark covert quid pro quo kind of thing. But that, nonetheless, I mean, does the guy have no shame on some level? I understand he's Mr. Compassion, he's Mr. Empathy, but these guys took a shot at him 4 days ago. The first statement to come out of the Bush administration on Monday, you know, in relation to the tsunami, which has now killed about 150,000 people, was in response to Clinton's opening his mouth in England, being a compassionate American diplomat who has every right to speak for this country. They're like, well, who the hell is that guy to talk? He's got a big mouth. He can't put his money where his mouth is. And, you know, he shouldn't, you know, our president, George Bush, is not just going to go for that, what do they say, what is Clinton's little tagline? What did they accuse him of?
Feeling pain.
Yeah, feeling, that's it. Right. The feeling the pain moment, which is, well, why shouldn't they have that? But nonetheless, he gets on TV with them yesterday, and I the cause is great, but I'm disappointed because there was a constant conversation about framing of arguments that the conservatives have appropriated all of the liberal frames, and now they've appropriated, you know, a Democratic president.
Well, can I bring up a frame for Clinton?
Sure.
Can I use this on the air?
What?
He's a whore. He's a fame whore.
So you think that it's really just about him, you know, getting back into the shine, getting back into the spotlight,
back on Larry King where he loves it, you know.
He's sitting there with George Bush Senior, you know, laughing. It makes you, it's one of those things where you, like, all of a sudden you realize, like, it is all one party. It is all one game. There is a quid pro quo that goes on. These guys have, you know, they have favors. They do favors for each other. It's a big game that's got nothing to do with us.
It's professional wrestling.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in the highest form. But I was getting angry. You know, I'm like, how can you stand there after these guys did nothing but crap on you for 10 years and have little jokes with George Sr., who also was saying, you know, that the whole reaction of the Democrats and the left to the sort of stalling on behalf of his son, you know, and the stingy, not just stingy, but, you know, embarrassing, shameful $15 million up to $35 million, and now $350 million because apparently somebody, Karl Rove, I guess, told him that, hey, it doesn't matter. You know, it's like Cheney saying deficits don't matter. It doesn't matter what number you use. Just jack it up. You know what I mean? Make them look like someone told him that if you play this right, you can look like the savior of the world. I believe that to be true. And George Bush Sr. said yesterday that, like, all that type of talk is just inside the beltway kind of stuff. And it's not. You know, we were talking about it. But we've got numbers, too, that you had an interesting article on your site. There's a couple things we want to do when we come back from break. On GNN, Anthony and his comrades there put together a list. I guess, is it your list?
Well, actually, it was from our friends from the Center for Corporate Responsibility.
The top 10 war profiteering corporations, companies, I guess, entities. We're going to go through that throughout the show. We'll start with the bottom three. And also, let's get into where that your sister, I guess, wrote a piece.
Yeah.
On funding that was pulled out, that the Bush administration pledged funding. This is before the tsunami. This came out
right before Christmas.
On your site, December 24th or 25th, about sort of some of the history of what it means when they do pledge money and what money really gets spent. So we'll be back with Anthony LaPay and a lot more. We've got a great show today. It's 14 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Hey, check us out at morningtradition.com where you can blog, email, and waste lots of time at work looking at our links.
Oh, how great is that? How can it make me cry every time I hear it? It's 19 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. You're listening to Morning Sedition. Mark Riley will be back tomorrow. Today in studio, filling in for Riley, is Anthony LaPay from the Guerrilla News Network. You can go there, GNN.TV, as we speak, and noodle around on that. Man, for some reason, that Tom Petty song just, you know, makes me cry. Kalo, I was getting all nostalgic this morning for no reason at all. For no reason at all. I don't know if it's my age. I don't know if it's because my wife just left. I don't know if it's because I ate a half a pint of ice cream last night and a half a candy bar and a half pint of frozen yogurt. I don't know if it has anything to do with that. But there's some moments where you're just sort of like, God, remember when everything was, you know, ahead of you and, you know, everything was cool. And you know those moments where you ever have, like, let me ask you, Anthony. I don't need to isolate you here. You ever have just a feeling that you get a wave of a feeling that you had maybe when you were 15, and you can't explain the feeling, but at that moment everything was really great and cool and you felt connected to all things, and it comes back and you're like, oh, how can I make that last forever? You ever have that?
Not with any legal substances.
All right. I understand that. All right, so let's get into the disaster that is Iraq, the ongoing disaster. In Baghdad, Governor Ali al-Hadri was assassinated Tuesday morning right in Baghdad. And this is a Baghdad that is supposedly safe for an election. Iraq's defense minister is raising the possibility that this month's election could be pushed back in an effort to persuade more Sunnis to take part in the vote. And about 50 people in the last 3 days have been killed. At least 16 people were killed yesterday, bringing the toll to over 50. You know, unbelievable. Earlier yesterday, an explosive-laden car blew up when a driver rammed a checkpoint outside the offices of interim Prime Minister Ayed Alawi's National Accord Party. A roadside bomb in Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit killed at least 6 Iraqi National Guardsmen and wounded 4. In Balad, about 50 miles north of the capital, a suicide car bomber killed 4 Iraqi soldiers and wounded 14 U.S. military spokesman Neil E. O'Brien said anti-Iraqi forces continue to target the Iraqi National Guard because the force is creating conditions for successful elections. Sounds like it. An Iraqi policeman died and 2 were wounded when a beheaded, booby-trapped corpse exploded in the northern city of Mosul. As Iraqi police officers secured the site and attempted to search the remains in order to identify the body. I mean, this is like completely out of control. Even we just put, 35,000 new troops in there. This election is now, you know, being thought not to happen, you know, because of what's going on. Now, you've got information. This is your beat, right?
Well, probably the biggest thing for me, though, that hit the wires in the last couple of days is the head of Iraqi's internal intelligence agency said, this is the interim government, the Iraqis themselves said that he puts the number of insurgents at 200,000.
So 200,000 strong insurgency, a multi-headed insurgency, going,
yes.
Which is comprised of Baathists. It's comprised of several different groups of jihadists. It's comprised of just malcontents.
And some of these guys are just local dudes in their neighborhood, you know, whose cousin's house was blown up, and there's so many guns are picking up, and they're just getting their revenge.
Right. They're just angry cats. The one thing they all have in common is that they don't like the Americans there. They like to kill Americans, and they are going to do everything they can to stifle this election.
And they're getting good at killing America. They're even better at killing Iraqis.
Well, that's, you know, this is like a very awesomely terrifying guerrilla war tactic, is to continue to kill their tribesmen and their people who are Iraqi, you know, as a threat, because they know at, you know, given time, even if it's 100 years, the sort of vision of tribal politics, you know, is thousands of years, you know, right? And really, when you think about it, these tribes have pre-existed, you know, anything that's going on there now, they pre-existed Saddam Hussein. Tribal politics have existed for, you know, probably thousands of years. So whatever they're thinking, they know that eventually the Americans will be gone, and if they keep hitting their Iraqi, you know, their countrymen, that warning will go out, and the message will become clear that, look, you know, if you keep aligning yourself with this imperial force, you know, there's going to be a price to pay for generations. So what were you saying before we got on about the Sunnis? Weren't you saying that some of the Sunnis are
The Shiites.
Yes,
sorry,
okay.
The Shiite leaders came out and said that they actually supported the Americans staying in the short term, which is interesting, because they hadn't really come out and talked specifically about what they think the American forces should do.
Sure.
And primarily that's because, you know, they know that the Americans are really in some ways holding the insurgents back from killing even more of the Shiite majority.
Right.
Because they are really, compared to the Sunni insurgents, they don't have the know-how, they don't have the guns, they don't have the kind of the military capabilities to protect themselves that the Sunni insurgents.
This is the Shia
majority, the everyday Shia people.
Sure.
Which is about 60% of the Iraqi people.
And they also see this as their time. I mean,
right.
Al-Sistani, the cleric, he's been very careful politically to wait to see how things, you know, sort of, you know, played out, and now it's become clear that they want to protect what they see as their big opportunity.
And the other thing that they said was they also made it clear publicly that they're not going to turn Iraq into an Iranian-style theocracy, and they won't, you know, be under the thumb of Iran. They said that publicly. You know, what they're really trying to do is position themselves to get the most support they can from the Americans in this short-term period so they can, you know, maintain as much power as they can. again as we go into the election.
Sure. So, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that it won't become that. But, you know, certainly as a good new political entity,
of course.
You know, lying to get whatever you can and the benefits that will protect your possibilities of winning are important. Now, let's go to, you know, given that, you know the death toll of Americans at this point is well over 1,300 people. The number of Iraqis, civilians and otherwise that have been killed, some numbers have it up to 100,000 people. Now, let's talk about this top 10 war profiteers, the people that are making money off of the bloodbath. You know, this is the top 10 war profiteers of 2004 that, you know, we got from GNN.TV, your site, and this comes from the Center for Corporate Responsibility. Let's start with number 10. Now, Qualcomm is number 10, who, oddly, I think made my phone. Is that true? These are the same guys that make phones for Sprint?
Oh, yeah. And the crazy thing was Qualcomm got this deal to do the cell phone network, even when their standard isn't the same standard that's used throughout the Middle East. They got this sort of sweetheart deal. Really, if you know, I talk to people all the time in Baghdad, the cell phone networks really suck. It's really
so
bad.
So I mean, that's something that's no different than here, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're telling me that there are insurgents sitting there going, I cannot get reception!
can you
hear me now?
Well, speaking of the cell phone networks, this is a hot rumor that's been, a lot of people on GNN have been talking about it, and I've been hearing it from getting some emails from Baghdad. One of the rumors on the street in Baghdad today is that the Iraqi government or the Americans are going to shut down the entire cell phone network throughout Iraq today.
Oh, really?
Going up to the elections. I don't know if it's true. Well, hopefully maybe I can email someone in Baghdad and see if their cell phones are working later.
Oh, that's
in the show.
Interesting. Can they just do that? I guess they could, huh?
They can do, yeah. I mean, they can do anything. I mean, that's why they brought in these companies, because so they can control the phone system.
And they can use it as a tactic. Number 9 is Laurel Satellite. Now, who are they?
They are a satellite company that is very tight with a group of neoconservative hawks in the Bush administration. The principal founder is
Bernard Schwartz.
It's you know, one of these super connected neocon companies.
And what do they make?
Well, work.
Yeah, this is let's see. It's short, very tired. Okay, yeah. I don't understand. Like, the industry said the war on terror literally saves some of satellite operators from. I wonder what kind of satellites they must be dealing with. TV transmissions. I'll look in. We'll get more information on that. I have it. We kind of stumbled on it. It's 28 past the hour. We'll be back with. We're going to talk about the Congress and a couple more of these companies. So stay with us. You're listening to Air America Radio.
On Air America Radio.
Past the hour, I'm Mark Maron. You're listening to Morning Sedition. Mark Riley coming back tomorrow. With me in the studio is our special guest co-host Anthony LaPay from the Guerrilla News Network. We were talking about the top 10 war profiteering contractors before. We will get to that in a minute. But Ramon, as just, you know, wearing a navy blue blazer and boxer shorts, brought in the Palm Pilot for today. This is Tom DeLay's Palm Pilot. Here we go. 8 o'clock a.m. Wake up. First day of congressional session. Roll over in bed and wake up lobbyists for the tobacco, military, pharmaceutical, and oil industries. Make them breakfast. 9 a.m. Buy newspaper. If the guy at the newsstand smiles and says, good morning, accuse him of conducting a vicious partisan witch hunt. 11 a.m. Rezone voting districts in Texas so the map looks like me on horseback. There you go. 11:30 a.m. Obtain morning pardon for afternoon misdeeds. Note, repeat as necessary. 1 p.m. During roll call, when Democrats say here, accuse them of conducting a vicious partisan witch hunt. 4:30 p.m. Obtain afternoon pardon for morning misdeeds. Note, repeat as necessary. 7 p.m. Go to kitchen for snack. If empty, accuse refrigerator of conducting a vicious partisan witch hunt. All right, let's get back. The problem, apparently, with the Laurel satellite thing, which is what we were talking about before, Anthony, is that they are a satellite company clearly listening to us. put some beam down
off,
into
man.
Our heads and caused a brain skid here in the studio.
They erased all my memory of them. That any idea?
Yeah,
any
it was amazing. It was amazing.
Gone.
We both, Anthony and I, both had a mutual brain skid on the Laurel satellite. So what they do what they do is they are a satellite company, because they are needed for space-based capacity. To be able to guide its the military's missiles.
It's all satellites over there. Mm-hmm. You know, everything that we do over there is guided by satellites. I remember sitting in a bunker in the Sunni Triangle, looking at these huge flat screens with live real time views of all of their vehicles as they move around.
Uh-huh.
You know, the area, including, you know, and they have these aerial drones flying, giving live pictures everywhere. So it's the satellite industry. Many people say was literally saved from bankruptcy by the war on terror. There's whole new networks of the military is actually going to be launching a whole new intranet to move beyond the internet, so they can be have
a secret internet, like a shadow internet,
a shadow secretive.
We all know about the neocon death cult, Death Star, the satellite that caused the tsunami and the voting machines to go crazy. It's like it's a multifaceted and multifunctional satellite that, of course, is responsible for everything that goes wrong, in the world.
And okay. Has Clinton under mind control.
That's clearly true. Clinton co-opted by the Republican neocon death cult propaganda machine. Now, number eight, and this is the last one we'll do. We're going to do a few an hour. Mm-hmm. Number eight, of course, Lockheed Martin.
Well, who could forget Lockheed Martin?
Mm-hmm.
They've only made a small $21.9 billion in 2003 contracts alone.
Wow. How much?
$21.9 billion.
This is $29.1 billion. I just want to make sure I understand, because our tsunami relief pledge by George Bush was $350 million. So Lockheed, this is just one. Number eight in a list of 10.
Yeah,
number seven. Or is it number eight? It's number eight in a list of 10 military contracts. So I'm assuming as we go up the list, there's more money at stake.
Is that 21.9 billion.
Wow.
I mean, that's a staggering thing when you look at these numbers. And some of these numbers are smaller, but when you see what they're for, when we move up into some of these other companies, they're getting these, you know, piddly contracts, $400 million for some translators.
That's it.
You know,
that's unbelievable.
Like that. The zeros are crazy.
So Lockheed Martin does satellites, planes, missiles, IT systems. They do just about, they're a sort of, shop at one place, one-stop shopping for war contracts.
You get your cruise missile, you get the satellite that launches it, you get the computer that aims it. Their stock, of course, has tripled since 2000.
Wow. So plenty of people making money. I mean, there are some Republicans. I mean, I saw Frank Pallone Jr., who's a congressman from New Jersey on Crossfire, going head-to-head with the dummy Tucker Carlson, who, in Pallone, was very matter-of-fact, very soft-spoken, very reasonable, and he was one of the few guys that I've ever seen. I'd never seen him before in my life. I don't even know what he does or who he is, but he handled himself very well, Tucker was doing his standard sort of, bow-tie dummy, BS, and saying, what's with the Democrats saying that, it took Bush too long to react and this, that, and the other thing. And then he started accusing Pallone of being paying for a warning system, a tsunami, global tsunami warning system. And Tucker's like, why should we have to pay for that? These aren't our people. Why should we have to give them anything? Which is a fairly, restrictive, unempathetic, kind of selfish disposition that a lot of neocons, a lot of conservatives have. And Pallone just said, look, ultimately it would be good for everybody and only cost $30 million.
Exactly.
$30 million. And of course, Tucker's like, yeah, but it doesn't make any sense. It's like, shut up. Shut up. Don't these guys believe in karma of any kind? Even if it's not karma, even if it's not some sort of, metaphysical, mystical element, how about reap what you sow, payback and all that other stuff? I mean, why can't we just do something good for the world and shut our traps?
Yeah, if you save money in the short, spend $30 million a year, we don't have to pay another $350 if you even pay it.
Well, but the genius was that Pallone, when Carlson got on him, said, he kind of countered him with a sort of conservative fiscal interest. He said, the United States has interests worldwide in almost every country, so on some level, to pay $30 million to have a warning system would help us protect our interests.
The Victoria's Secret factory almost got leveled.
Wow.
In Indonesia. If we're talking about global interest.
Yeah, imagine how many people would have been heartbroken about that. Well, let's talk about this tsunami relief. Let's talk about your sister's piece that you have up on your network, because it's interesting to me is that this came out before the tsunami. It is about a Bush pledge that was reneged upon? Is that what that
is,
Andy?
Well, my sister Anna wrote a piece right before Christmas entitled What Would Santa Do? About how the Bush administration had announced a cut of $100 million on one of our most crucial aid initiatives, basically helping the poor and hungry people around the world feed themselves.
Right.
So you just, you know, this is just an example of the kind of cuts that this administration has really been making across the board. And it also brings up this really interesting sort of perception versus reality thing that I think a lot of Americans are confused about. You know, a lot of Americans, if you listen to CNN or any of these news networks, Americans are the most generous nation in the world.
Right.
Most of the polls show that Americans believe that we give about 20% of our gross national product as foreign aid to poor countries around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Reality is it's a fraction of 1%.
It's so interesting to me because if I was asked that question, I would have no idea. I mean, unless they gave me a multiple choice, you know, I had no idea that we even had. I know that there were private philanthropies, but the idea of the U.S. government, you know, giving anything away, especially this administration, would think lower.
Right. And the problem is that, you know, we make these pledges, mm-hmm. like this Millennium Challenge pledge that the economist Jeffrey Sachs brought up in 2000, which was, you know, to try to end global poverty and AIDS and malaria and all these other things. And we, you know, we pledge all this money and then we never give it.
Well, that was a pledge of up to $5 billion a year, and the account has yet to disperse a single dollar. All right. And during the State of the Union address in 2003, Bush pledged $3 billion a year over 5 years to combat AIDS in Africa. However, his budgets have shorted that promise by nearly $1 billion over the first 2 years. All right. Victims of the earthquake in Bam, Iran, a year ago are still living in tents because USAID has not materialized in the amounts pledged. Now, I'm not saying that the gesture is not, you know, valid, but I'm saying that, you know, do not miss, you know, understand that, you know, to go from $35 million to $350 million is a political move to make this administration look benevolent, which is crazy because they're not. They don't care. They really don't care about anything but global business. So unless they cut some sort of deals, you know, in giving, you know, certain companies, you know, contracts on rebuilding some of these countries, the $350 million, I think, is just a phantom number that came out of a political machine that wants to appear benevolent. And the fact that Bill Clinton is jumping on board with these Republicans. Now, again, I think, you know, if you want to be involved in the relief effort, if you want to go to Morning Sedition and find out where you can donate money, if you want to donate money, I think what, you know, President Clinton and First President Bush are doing is noble, but I don't know why he had to align himself with these idiots. Now, I'm just saying basically that I think it's sort of a sham, and that, you know, what should have happened is that he should have responded quicker, number one. And number two, you know, I think that what's happening now is the politicization of an international catastrophe. And also, I do want to say that apparently they don't want you to send clothing. They don't want you to send bunk beds. They don't want you to send mattresses. They need money because they don't know how to move you know, stuff that you were going to, you know, maybe try to get rid of anyways, or to, you know, give that stuff to Goodwill or local charity. What they need for this is just cash. And I just want a couple other numbers. The war in Iraq costs $177 million per day. $500 million funds 40 hours of the Iraq War. The Bush and Kerry campaigns, Republican and Democratic parties, and independent groups spent more than $500 million on TV ads during the 2004 presidential campaign. The total cost to the taxpayer to operate Air Force One is $180 million a year. You know, even if they do give $350 million in relation to the numbers we're talking about in the private sector or even in the government sector, it's minimal. It's small. It's 44 past the hour. I'm here with Anthony LaPay. You're listening to Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Forty-nine past the hour. Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition. Mark Riley returning tomorrow from England with some stories. I hope he's got some stories. Man, we had to stop Wayne Gilman from telling too much yesterday. That was wild. Today in the co-host seat, Anthony LaPay from the Guerrilla News Network. We are talking about many things. Now we're going to listen to some sound. George Bush, you know, sat and, you know, stood in front of the newly elected pig pack, which is Congress, to, you know, to sort of see and welcome them aboard and tell them, you know, why it's so important that they do what they do. Can we hear that, Kayla?
Lauren, I know how hard it is on a family to be in the political arena. It's the ultimate sacrifice, really. Sacrifice your privacy. Sacrifice time with your kids. But you're going to find it's worthwhile. Serving this great country is an unbelievable honor. And both the elected official and the spouse are serving our great country.
It sounds like he didn't know where he was. I think he was supposed to be addressing maybe a group of military families. The ultimate sacrifice is putting your life at risk or dying, you know, for your country in the military. This is a president that will not attend military funerals, and he's talking to a group of, you know,
millionaires.
Millionaires, retired, you know, surgeons, insurance salesmen, whatever sort of, you know, lackeys end up in Congress, and telling them that they're making the ultimate sacrifice and that he's going to, you know, it's a great honor to be able to receive kickbacks in the name of your constituents, you know, for yourself, you know, by making, more pork. Is that it? Is that how it works, Anthony? Am I wrong?
I hate to say it, you're right.
Now, this is some interesting stuff about, you know, Tom DeLay is the House Republicans changed the rules regarding party leadership. You know, the original rule that forced leaders to step down if indicted was adopted by House Republicans in 1993 in order to highlight Democrats' ethical lapses. Now, they were about to, you know, they threw that out. Not long ago, just recently, they decided to get rid of that because DeLay was under some heat. All right. So now, as of today, January 3rd, 2005, yesterday, what is it? Is it today? Let me look at my watch. Yeah, yesterday, the rule change was voided because they got so much flack. But apparently, someone's going to take the fall. Speaker J. Dennis Hastert, you know, the wrestling coach, you know, the one of the king pigs, is, you know, trying to decide whether or not he's going to replace the chairman of the Ethics Committee, Joe Heffley, a Republican from Colorado, with somebody else. So they're basically acting, you know, in response to these attacks. And, of course, they attacked Pelosi, you know, a couple weeks ago. They just, you know, started raining down on her. Now, Republicans want to make it harder to discipline lawmakers under House ethics rules. That's obvious. Republicans may change the rules to end the Democrats' filibusters of judicial nominees, but I don't know if today was encouraging or not encouraging in the sense that there was some decorum honored.
Well, it was sort of a rare backtrack. You know,
right.
They haven't seen many of those
right.
On the Republican side.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. And, you know, whether or not that's going to continue, who knows? Because, you know, Bill Frist has been threatening this, you know, this nuclear option, which is to, you know, make it majority rule as opposed to allow filibusters, which is going to be essential because, you know, the congressional process of approving nominations, both judicial and otherwise, you know, in terms of the Alberto Gonzalez, you know, this type of work, I mean, you know, hopefully it can remain bipartisan without these guys completely taking over the Congress in, like, a fascistic way.
Yeah, I'm not sure this really means that much because this was just such an egregious sort of trick, that move they were trying to pull.
Yeah.
Not really sure whether this means they're
Of course it doesn't. And now the tort reform issue is going to be, at the front because Bush is now going to try and push through, you know, tort reform, and he's going to try to push through his Social Security changes, which is not necessarily privatizing, but certainly corporatizing or, at the very least, you know, taking the money of people who you know, want to be guaranteed something, you know, and just, you know, throwing it on red or number seven or number six. But the president does plan an appearance in Collinsville, in a county across the Mississippi River from St. Louis that is infamous for its volume of lawsuits. This will serve as the first public spotlight in Bush's bid for congressional approval of limits on the size of damage awards won in court. So we don't like to call it tort reform. We'd rather call it restricting victims' rights. All right, President Bush and Vice President Cheney. And he continued to dishonestly claim that trial lawyers are to blame for skyrocketing health care costs. President Bush says frivolous lawsuits run up the cost of medicine and that solutions to health care problems were stopped in Congress because the trial lawyers are powerful in the Senate. This is crap.
It was that guy you had on yesterday. It was amazing.
Yeah, Dan Peter Rost. Yeah, you know, Peter Rostock from pharmaceutical company, from Pfizer.
Yeah.
That was heavy stuff. You know, Dan Ziegart is the guy who writes about tort reform with the cigarettes, and he's also he's the one who sort of like hipped us to the framing of restricting victim rights. But Ross was frightening.
Yeah.
It was frightening because he was fairly, you know, he was congenial. He was on the inside. He still had his job, and he was basically confirming the fact that they care about nothing but money. We all knew that, but they are able to jack up, you know, pharmaceutical costs, that the research that they do is bogus. guess all they want to do is update existing medicines to stifle patents, you know, so that the generics are not available to people that need medicine. It's horrendous. All right. The government and academic data concludes that lawsuits have little, if anything, to do with health care costs. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, costs from malpractice lawsuits represent less than 2% of the nation's total health care spending. All right, the tort reform legislation pushed by President Bush would reduce health insurance premiums by less than one-half of 1%. So it's already starting to reveal itself as a sham. All right, now they're starting with doctors. All right, they're starting with doctors because, you know, doctors do pay a lot of malpractice insurance. My father, you know, was a surgeon, and one of the reasons why he doesn't get back into it is because it costs so much money. But if they start putting, you know, caps on this, if they start saying that, you know, the malpractice stuff, it's only going to apply to the corporations, which is what they really want to do. Bush has claimed that lawsuits cause docs to practice medicine in an expensive way in order to protect themselves in the courthouse. A study by the Harvard University School of Public Health, quote, did not find a strong relationship between the threat of litigation and medical costs, end quote. So the insurance companies are jacking up the prices on their own volition because of stocks, because of the stock market. A study in the Journal of Health and Economics compared medical costs in states with limits on lawsuits to states without limits and found only tiny savings, less than 0.3%. We're going to get more into this a little more in detail later because we want to talk about Alberto Gonzalez a bit. Because, you know, he's going to be approved, probably.
Most likely.
Know, our first guest today is going to be talking about that. He's a former Navy, a former Navy lawyer, John Hudson, is going to talk about the growing number of military law experts who are opposing the confirmation of Alberto Gonzalez for Attorney General. So that, you know, that should be interesting, you know, because this guy sort of, he's compromised the entire definition of torture, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I describe him, this guy has been like Bush's consigliere. He's been the guy behind the scenes writing up, he's like the ultimate yes man.
Yeah.
He's given this administration, it goes back to when Bush was governor, telling him what he wants to hear.
Oh, absolutely. When he was supposed to do the profiles of people on death row,
right.
And he would just basically, he'd just put a couple of notes and go kill him. And Bush would go, kill him? Yeah, kill him. All right, here's the liberal agenda today from the Streisand compound. One, to protest FCC, organize alternate Super Bowl halftime show produced by Larry Flint. Two, work with the AARP to recruit Canadian drug mules to smuggle low-cost prescription drugs across the border. There you go. Senior citizen drug mules. Three, work with the... Come on, Grandma, put this where no one can find it. Three, work with designers to make fake fur jackets look faker. Four, propose new liberal constitutional amendments, the right to keep and bear a grudge. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Bush and Clinton working together? The dominoes are falling, man. One party, one religion, one mind. Get fitted for your uniform, sheeple. Wake up! All right, we'll be back. Everything's falling apart here now. John Hudson, the JAG, who's going to talk about Alberto Gonzalez and much more. Anthony LaPace here, 58 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Mark Maron here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians of all kinds, especially those with no sense of humor. I like them the best because they get all worked up and send me emails and go crazy. Mark Riley coming back tomorrow after a very nice long vacation, I would say. Wouldn't you, Kalo, say that Mark Riley's had a very nice long vacation?
Lucky.
Yes, I'll say. He will be back tomorrow if everything goes properly. Thank you, Dan Passman, son of Lewis and Linda Passman, for dropping that water right in front of me. I appreciate that. God, doors are opening. People are moving around here.
Brendan, a lot of movement here.
I know. That's that voice that you don't recognize, Anthony LaPay from GNN.TV, the Guerrilla News Network. He is co-hosting this morning. P.W. McDonald leaving the house here. He was just sitting in for Kalo, who was returning as I started talking. And then Dan came through that door and gave me some. It was like a Marx Brothers movie. Movie for a second there. There was a lot of things going on, none of them particularly funny, but the potential was there for a comedy of errors to unfold. So Anthony, we've been talking about a lot of different stuff. We're going to talk about Alberto Gonzalez in just a second. Let me get this off my chest. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, if today is today Tuesday or Wednesday?
Tuesday.
Oh, my God. Really? All right. Well, Thursday, I think I'm going to therapy for the first time in a month. All right. Here's my, thank God. Here's my dream diary. I don't even want to talk about yesterday. All right. I don't even want to talk about the ice cream, the sadness, the candy bars, the nap. Have you ever had? Do you ever hate yourself so much you got to take a nap, Anthony?
Oh, almost every day.
Okay. The nap of self hatred followed by ice cream, and then there was the weird sugar rush of like, hey, I'm okay, I'm a good guy, and then there was some very insane blues guitar playing that I thought was inspired, but it might just be my new Pod 2.0 making me sound like a genius, and then the crash. It's nothing worse than getting sad after you play the blues. Because, you know, the blues are supposed to relieve all that. Man, then the ice cream, and then the sleep, and then the cats. You know, I haven't checked in with that in a while. Well, you know, we got things to do. I'll talk about my cats later, but I have to be honest with you. My wife, something about having my wife in the house has made my cats very loving. One of them, like the male, the monkey, he's like a completely different cat than the insane, you know, little monster mongoose cat that wedged itself between the screen and the window when I got it. I you know, if I have kids, you know, I don't know. Do you have kids?
No.
Are you thinking about it?
Thinking about it a lot.
Yeah. You can take action. All right, here we go.
It doesn't work just thinking about it?
No. Yeah, it'll change your life. You know, I've lost a lot of friends to children. It's true, my buddy Sam. Dude, what's up? We hanging out? No, I got the kids on the roof. I have to go up and... All right, here we go. Here's my dream diary from last night. George Bush, Bill Clinton, and George Bush Jr. finishing their press conference about the tsunami aid efforts. They take off their mics, and Bush Sr. and Clinton walk off together, leaving Jr. to trail along behind them. Over his shoulder, Bush Sr. says to Jr., now that's how a president acts. Not screwing around on the ranch for a week. There's not that much brush to clear in the whole world. Jr. says, but Dad, Clinton says to Sr., disobedient, isn't he? I bet he was a devil, the toilet train. Sr. says, he sure was, Bill. I never saw a child so proud of his poop. I guess me and Barb shouldn't have praised him so much. After all, everybody poops. Junior says, but Senior says, quiet, boy. Can't you see the grown-ups are speaking? They walk outside, and all three get into a limo. Bush Senior and Clinton sit in the back while Junior has to ride in front with the driver, who tells him to sit still and not fiddle with the radio station. Clinton says, so how long did you have to get on his case before he agreed to this? Senior says, 4 days. I had to have Rove convince him that this was something I would never do. Clinton says, well, whatever works. Senior says, that's the problem. That jug had never worked a day in his life. That's my fault, I guess. I know that. And now that he's won his second term, he's just a total pain in the ass. Clinton says, I felt pretty good about winning my second term. Of course, I had something to feel good about. Budget surplus, 4 years of peace, respected in the world. Don't you ever look at him and say, where the hell did you come from? In the front seat, Junior was burning his fingertips with a cigarette lighter. Senior sighs and says, every day, Bill, every day. I woke up and my bed was filled with magnolias for some reason. So, that's my mind, Anthony. So let's talk about Alberto Gonzalez, as most everybody knows, as you said, is you were surprised because...
Well, it's, you know, who would have thought they could have come up with someone scarier than John Ashcroft?
For different reasons, because this guy's...
this guy's on the ball.
Right.
He's writing memos.
Right. Yeah, Ashcroft was sort of like... Ashcroft was like a kind of a... He didn't know that he was a devil, you know, and he was sort of like... He was sort of out there as, you know, a religious ideologue. Now, this guy is sort of a behind-the-scenes kind of like, you know, working the puppet strings.
You know, it goes way back to January 2002.
Mm-hmm.
He was working hand-in-hand with Rumsfeld and the administration, trying to craft the legalese to allow them to do the kind of stuff they've been doing basically since the beginning of 2002 across the world, detaining people indefinitely, beating them up, and basically kind of just doing whatever the hell they want to do.
Right, and now that, you know, they're trying to, you know, I guess they're trying to figure out a way to hold the detainees who are not accused of anything or guilty of anything particularly, to hold them forever.
Right.
They're trying to figure out a way to do that. It's some sort of, I think it's called, I think Plan 6, or I'll double check it. But they also do this other thing, which I didn't know about, is that what you were talking about, the Geneva Conventions before, can we summarize that before we get on the phone with
our guys? Yeah, well, what's really interesting about what they've been able to do in terms of writing these legal memos to set the stage for the torture that's been going on, mm-hmm. is that There is some legal wiggle room in the Geneva Conventions. The Geneva Conventions were really created by the victors, you know, of the two great wars.
Right.
Yeah. So they really are designed to protect standing armies in uniform.
Right.
So that's why the administration came up with this term, enemy combatant.
So that was a loophole for them to approve of torture,
which it refers to basically out of no uniform. Insurgent or terrorist, whatever you want to call them.
So that was their way. And let's talk to our guest now. You know, on the phone joining us, retired Rear Admiral. He's a former Navy JAG. He's dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center. His name is John Hudson. Good morning, Mr. Hudson.
Good morning.
I'm very happy you're here. Now, apparently, you and a growing number of distinguished military officers are opposing Gonzalez's nomination. What prompted your decision to come forward against him?
Well, I was listening into what you were just talking about, and that is largely it. I believe that Judge Gonzalez, who is a fine man, I'm sure, fails utterly to understand the role of the United States on the international, the world scene, that we have stood for generations upon generations as the primary advocate for the rule of law and human rights. And now we find ourselves in a position where we're looking for ways to evade those obligations, to avoid providing the fundamental human rights for detainees. And I think that is a huge misstep of historical proportions. And I think that at a more modern viewpoint, it imperils our troops and makes us less safe.
Mm-hmm. Admiral, on that point, that's one of the things that really scares me the most, especially being in Iraq and meeting a lot of soldiers. How is this putting our soldiers in peril?
Well, I think in a number of ways. One is that it has led inexorably, I believe, to the horrific pictures that we've seen that have come out of Abu Ghraib and some of the abuses that have occurred in Guantanamo and Afghanistan. That embitters the enemy. It serves as a recruiting poster for the enemy. It makes it less convenient for potential allies to align themselves with us because we're seen as sort of an international outlaw trying to avoid the Geneva Conventions rather than to use them to our advantage. And so for those reasons, I think it makes it the war becomes unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Geneva Conventions, part of the advantage or the one important aspect of the Geneva Conventions is that they allow you to engage in the peace that you hope will follow because you have not engaged in an unlimited warfare. It's like spouses. You know, mm-hmm. You get in an argument, and you don't want to say something that you can never take back that will hurt forever.
Yeah, I've made that mistake.
Yeah,
haven't we all? This guy's a JAG and Dr. Phil at the same time. Maybe he can do some counseling for us after the call.
But I think that's the case. And
yeah.
We're going to spend generations trying to recover from the pictures that came out of Abu Ghraib with Lindy England and Grenier and Frederick and all those guys.
Generations, maybe an eternity, because given the nature of digital technology, those things are never going to go away.
Well, that's right. And the enemy has an incredibly long memory,
mm-hmm.
is very patient, and, we're going to pay the price. And it all began at the top, and it all began back in those days when, as you were talking about earlier, we were trying to figure out ways to sort of reverse engineer the legal analysis. You know, we'll start out with the conclusion that the Geneva Conventions don't apply, and then because we're clever lawyers, we'll figure out a way to make them not apply.
Right. If you had a chance, Admiral, what would you ask Gonzalez at his confirmation hearing?
I'd ask him whether he still believes that the Geneva Conventions are quaint and obsolete, as he referred to them
mm-hmm.
in his January 2002 memo. I would ask him to explain his analysis where he talks about the interplay between the War Crimes Act, which is domestic legislation, and the Geneva Conventions, and essentially points out that grave breaches, a term of art, grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions are war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't want the Geneva Conventions to apply because he says essentially, he uses some legalese, but he's essentially saying we may end up committing grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions and therefore war crimes in our fight against terror. So we don't want the Geneva Conventions to apply.
That's incredible.
That's incredible. It's reprehensible and unbecoming the United States.
Now, Admiral,
certainly the law enforcement officer of the United States, the Attorney General.
Right. Now, this guy basically is implicated in probably one of the biggest scandals to hit American government in the last, 10 years. Why do you think he has a chance to be confirmed?
that's a good question, and I don't know. I mean, how did, what made President Bush think that he was going to be a good nominee?
It's fixed. The fix is in, Admiral.
Well, one wonders. I mean, it is... I think it's a slap in the face of our allies. After the pictures that come out of Abu Ghraib and the investigations into death and abuses, in several different countries.
Right. Well, let me just bring that.
Why
that
him?
Yeah. Let me bring that up. Lastly, I mean, this isn't just I've been reporting on this since 2002. This just isn't about Abu Ghraib. This is happening in Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. It's happening in secret locations all over the world. Right.
Right. We have over 40 death investigations that are going on right now where people have died while in our custody with apparently, at least, we're doing investigations, but it looks like it might be the result of abuse from, a number of different locations. It's not just Abu Ghraib. It's not just a few bad apples, as was so famously referred to.
Well, they do that thing called renditioning, which is basically outsourcing torture, right?
Extraordinary rendition, which is where you take, because we are not supposed to engage in torture, we send prisoners to other countries.
It's outsourcing.
Yeah, it's outsourcing.
Outsourcing your torture.
Yeah. Hey, I really appreciate your time with us, Admiral Hudson, and thank you for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure indeed.
Okay,
thank you,
take care. That was the outsourcing torture thing is that's a loophole that's going to exist no matter who's in there, and they're going to use that through the CIA. I'm with Anthony LaPay. We just heard from Admiral John Hudson, a retired JAG, who was. It's coming up. We've got the Liberal Confessional. We've got more with Anthony. We've got some pretty interesting guests coming up. John Howard Kunstler is going to discuss.
I love this guy.
Yeah, he's kind of out there, and he's got a bleak but honest vision of the future. We'll be back. It's Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. It's more than just a commute companion.
Listen online at morningsedition.com when you get to work, courtesy of Air America Radio.
Twenty-five past the hour, Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. My guest host today is Anthony LaPay from GNN, Guerrilla News Network. That's GNN.TV. Mark Riley will be returning tomorrow from England with some tall tales to tell, I imagine, about soccer and whatnot. I hope he had a good time. He will be in tomorrow, so rest assured, people. Some people have been asking about Riley. We got the Liberal Confessional coming up, and it's always a very popular bit of business because we all are sort of teeming with things that we want to confess. Even the other day when we talked to that dude, Jimmy Massey,
yeah.
Is it? The Marine recruiter, I asked him at the end of our interview if he had anything he wanted to share. I literally said, do you have anything you want to confess? And he did. He said the thing he felt worst about was telling a guy with a neurological disorder to lie on the test. But the guy, the drill sergeant immediately noticed. But anyways, sometimes it is hard being a liberal. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time. But when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now it's my turn. So bless me, Brother Anthony, for I've sinned. Yeah.
Help me, my son. How can I ease your burden?
Well, I've been ruminating on Bush's response to the tsunami disaster.
Yes, the president certainly could have done more.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I think that Bush has really stepped up to the plate with the $350 million in aid.
But, Mark, do you realize what you're saying?
Yeah, I do, man. But I'm actually saying that Bush is helping those in need. God, I feel dirty for saying that.
Do not fret, my son. What you see as sin is really a virtue.
Wait, why? Because of the ability to acknowledge a good deed by someone who is on the other side of the ideological line from us is a liberal virtue?
Exactly.
Then why do I feel like such a wuss?
Look deep into your heart for the answer, Mark.
All right, well, look, you know, looking deep into one's heart is also kind of wussy, all right? But, well, okay, wait a minute. I think I'm having a profound spiritual revelation. All right, no matter how much money Bush gives to tsunami relief, when you take stuff like the war and this whole Social Security privatization scam into account, you can't help but conclude that there's no tidal wave big enough to wash away all the slime and sleaze and scum that this administration promotes on a daily basis.
Hallelujah! See, your liberal soul is intact. Now go forth and sin no more.
Wow! Brother Anthony, I thank you for not making me do penance. But a confessional is no fun without penance, so call us, 866-303-2270. 866-303-2270. And you've got one coming back. We got to go right now, though. So give us a call. It's Air America Radio, 28 past the hour.
On Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, I'm Mark Maron. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We are now taking liberal confessions, 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. My guest host today, Anthony LaPay from Guerrilla News Network, that's GNN.TV. Anthony, you've shared some interesting confessions. You have a confession.
Well, you know, I figured you were confessing. I'm sitting here in a booth with you. I should confess as well.
Uh-huh.
I have a confession.
Okay, what is it? What is it, Anthony? Let me see if I can help you.
I eat meat.
Yeah, so that's not that big a deal.
Well, you know how people say, well, you know, somebody wrote the book on this or wrote the book on. Well, my mother sort of wrote the book on vegetarianism.
The book?
The book, yeah. For a lot of people, probably a lot of Air America listeners. Actually, the year I was born, 1971, she wrote a book called Diet for a Small Planet, which outlined how there's enough food in the world to go around if everyone didn't eat meat.
Wow. So you, her son, are you her only son?
Yeah.
Her only son, eating of the flesh.
Yeah.
Now, do you do this in front of her?
I try not to.
You say, avert your eyes.
Exactly.
I'm feeding.
I crawl under the table.
Don't watch this, Mom. Wow, so I would say that your penance would be to probably, you know, to eat a strict vegetarian diet, but I'm sure you had to do that for most of your life.
Right, well, that would kind of ruin the whole, you know, pleasure of the sin, wouldn't it?
But hold on a minute, man. So you grew up with this sort of like tofu
beans
cutlets.
And rice.
Beans and rice. Tofu cutlets. Seitan.
Oh, yeah.
Plenty of seitan.
Oh, yeah. Carob.
Oh, carob chip.
Oh.
Dude. So, like, at one point, it's weird because most of us were probably just thinking about, you know, having sex and doing drugs. You were just sort of like, soon I'm going to have a burger.
A burrito.
Do you remember your first meat?
Yeah. Well, luckily, you know, I used to like hanging out at my dad's house, you know.
He had
the lamb shanks.
Oh, that's hilarious. So you go to your dad's house, your parents are not together. You'd be like, come here, kid. Let me show you how to live.
Exactly.
That's terrific.
I got cover, though. Luckily, my sister, I'm the black sheep. My sister actually is a super veggie. She's writing a veggie cookbook herself. So
that's what the world needs.
I'm kind of off the, you know, I'm
another
off the
veggie cookbook.
It does.
And why do they keep insisting that they can make this food interesting? That's right. You know what? That's wrong of me to say.
I didn't say that, Mom. That was it.
I'm going to get nothing but flack. I like a vegetarian cuisine.
I do. As a side dish.
I don't eat a lot of meat. I really don't. Though yesterday I had some fantasies about eating a big steak.
For the record,
yeah,
I only really try to eat organic and free-range meat.
Well, I don't know what your penance is. I think that I guess your penance would have to be to try not to rub it in your mom's face. I mean, you know, you got to respect your mom on some level.
Yeah, they're too late now.
All right, well, I'm going to have to work out some other penance. Does your mom get mad at you? Do you still get the guilt look?
No, she's a very non-judgmental person.
Oh, come on.
Really?
Oh,
she's the most non-judgmental. For her thing, she's not really as much of an animal a lover type, though she likes animals. I don't want to get her hate mail from PETA, but... you know, it's more about the global economic system and world hunger and cutting down the rainforest and things like that. So it's much more of a larger political thing. So I try to eat organic and locally grown, you know, locally raised meats. I think that's, you know, at least gets me back in good stead.
Well, I think our guest, you know, or later in the show, this John Howard Kunzler is going to talk
about
local food economies and about you know, the repercussions of our oil running out on, you know, being able to transport food. It's sort of interesting stuff. But that's getting off the point. I have to say that although your mother is non-judgmental, even when those who claim to be non-judgmental see something that they don't necessarily approve of, somewhere inside the mind there is something going, oh, why is he doing that? It's wrong. So
thanks for that, Mark.
Sure, and I know she's listening. Maybe we should have your mom call. If you're out there, 866-303-2270. What's your mom's name?
Francis.
Yeah, Francis, give us a call so we can talk. I want to know if you're really non-judgmental about your son's eating habits. 866-303-2270. Let's take some confessions here. April in Portland, Maine, good morning.
Morning.
How are you? What's going on?
Oh, fine.
Oh, you sound exasperated.
Yeah, well, I'm calling to confess. It's something that I've been thinking about for about the last month, and I just have not gotten off my butt to do it, and I keep coming up with excuses why I can't do it.
What is it?
I really want to do something to protest the whole confirmation of Alberto Gonzalez.
Okay.
And the thing is here in Maine, we have two moderate Republican senators.
Okay.
Who I truly feel don't really agree with a lot of the policies for Bush, and I feel like if we could get enough voices to at least here in Maine to, you know, write to them and say, you know, vote against this guy, maybe it won't be enough to keep him from getting confirmed, but it would be something.
Yeah. So you've been sort of stalling on activating.
Right, yeah. I mean, my mother gave me the idea of, you know, because I couldn't figure out where to start. So my mom gave me the idea of just sending out letters to 100 people.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, about this guy, you know, and contact your senators. But the thing is I don't want to just send out these letters saying, don't vote for this guy because I said so. I want to, you know, give them reasons, actual factual reasons. And, you know, it's taking the time to find the actual factual
Well, can you send her to your site?
Yeah, well, maybe we'll put something up on GNN.TV. I mean, this JAG that we spoke to earlier is retired admiral. I mean, he had some great points. I think it's always good to use, you know, people with those kind of credentials, especially when you're trying to appeal to Republicans. To get on your side.
So
that's a great idea.
April, here's your penance. I mean, you've got to find this stuff out. I've got a few things right in front of me. Because first of all, Gonzalez believes many Geneva Convention provisions are obsolete. All right,
right.
That was in the memo. He also admitted his views could undermine U.S. military culture. In the January 2002 memo shows Alberto Gonzalez was aware of the risk that ignoring the Geneva Convention could create for the military. It could, quote, could undermine U.S. military culture, which emphasizes maintaining the highest standards of conduct in combat and could introduce an element of uncertainty into the status of adversaries. There's something else. Gonzalez approved a memo for authorizing torture, of course.
Is there a site or something where you can actually...
You know where you can go? You can either go... Yeah, I don't know if GNN, he says he's going to put something
later
on there,
today.
Go to Center for Progressive Research, right?
Okay.
That's a CPR. Wait, do we have a link for that, Larson, on our site? Is it centerforprogressiveresearch.com? Center for American Progress, that's it. For American Progress, and they usually have talking points on everything, and they certainly have all the information you will need on Alberto Gonzalez.
AmericanProgress.org.
AmericanProgress.org. That only took us three tries to get the right to website. So, you know, AmericanProgress.org, April, and I guarantee you, not only will you learn something when you go there about him, but that site will blow your mind if you've never been there. So that's your penance. It sounds kind of fun, right?
Yeah.
AmericanProgress.org. Go for it. And good luck with the mailing. I'm sure that you will do it.
I will. Thank you.
Okay, April. Bye. That's hilarious. We know exactly what you should do. It's only going to take two or three shots at getting the right name for the... All right, Kim, listening to LIB and NIAC, what's up?
Hi.
Hello.
It's killing me. I got to put my son in the Boy Scouts.
Oh, my God. Are you sure?
Well, he is Beaver from Leave It to Beaver. He should have been born, like, in the 1950s.
How did this happen? What did you do?
Well... We're activists. I mean, we've had Fred Phelps come to our community.
No, but yeah.
We've been out there protesting against him.
You know?
But my son, I mean, we're in the suburbs. He doesn't have fields to run through, and he's just that kind of kid. And I have no choice but to put him in the Boy Scouts.
He's a rebel, not tire.
Yeah, but he's that's a very strange predicament you're in. So. Well, you can do what my mom did. You know, my mother, I wanted to be in the Cub Scouts, so she put me in the Cub Scouts, but because she was relatively inattentive, she could never sew the patches on properly. So, you know, maybe...
I can't sew.
You can't sew? There you go. So you're going to ruin it for him anyways.
Now, of course, you know, part of the problem is, are you worried because this is an organization that discriminates against homosexuals?
Oh,
is that part of it?
Absolutely, and
yeah.
Plus the religion that we are, which is Unitarian, they can't even put their patch, the religion patch, on their sleeves because we're like the only banned religion from the Boy Scouts.
What's a Unitarian patch? A big question mark?
Yeah, exactly. But we're not allowed in there because we openly accept gays and atheists into our congregation.
It's sort of ironic given that, you know, the Boy Scouts is a sort of like, you know what I'm saying. You got to talk your kid out of it. That's your penance. Can't you encourage him to do something more interesting and more individualistic? Tell him that the little medals you get for whittling and that kind of stuff is not really what it means.
It's not going to get you into college.
Whittling, huh?
Yeah, whatever they do. I he's going to learn the wrong kind of things there anyways. What do you think?
I'll try.
All right. Thanks for calling us, Kim. You know, all right, we got to go. Are we going to take some more calls? Or what? Yeah, okay. 866-303-2270. We're having a good time listening to your confessions. But my mom did screw up my patches, and that screwed up our inspection. I didn't even have a hat. I didn't have a Cub Scout hat. I showed up for inspection with the patches on the wrong arm.
Oh, no, that's dramatic.
You know, that's a long list of stuff that my mother did to, but that was probably good. I learned that it was meaningless to wear a uniform, and of course I was in the loser troop. And I don't want to even go here. 45 past the hour, it's Air America Radio.
Join the Morning Sedition. Call 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition. My guest host today, Anthony LaPay from Guerrilla News Network, GNN.TV. Mark Riley returning tomorrow. We're taking your liberal confessions at 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. Carol in Long Island, good morning. What do you have to confess, Carol?
Good morning. What do I have to confess? I'm married to a right-wing Republican and have been for almost 40 years.
Oh, my God. That's...
It gets harder and harder. People don't know why I stay married. I don't know why myself. Since the election, he keeps lauding over about how wonderful Bush is and does.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, he keeps saying, you know, we won because we're moral, and I thank God every moment I'm immoral because I wouldn't vote for that idiot if you paid me. If my life is on it.
So, Carol,
what do I do? Short of divorce.
Well, either you're going to have to abstain from sex with this man for the rest of time, or leave him perhaps, or just slowly sabotage him and drive him crazy.
Maybe we should get the JAG Dr. Phil back on the line. Maybe they could work this out.
I think he drives me crazy and on purpose because he used to listen to Rush Limbaugh a lot.
Oh, my God.
He doesn't do that anymore, but now he's, you know, everything Bill O'Reilly says.
Oh, there's got to be, you know, you've been married to him long enough to know the little things that'll drive him crazy. I just, you know, slowly start moving things that he puts certain places, make him think that he's losing his mind.
Well, I've been thinking of getting rid of pay TV just to get rid of Bill O'Reilly.
Well, how are you going to do that without him being on to it?
Very simple. I'll just cancel it and, hey, I pay the bills.
You're paying the bills and putting up with that crap?
Well, I mean, I write out the checks.
Oh, okay.
I make money, I make money, you know, that sort of thing.
I do. I think that sounds like the good penance. It's just slowly cut them off of everything.
Right.
But
okay.
Don't get yourself into too much trouble, Carol. Thanks for sharing with us.
Oh, anytime.
Okay.
Good listening to you. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
it's so funny because she's got this tone. It's like, I don't know what I'm going to do. She's at the end of her rope. I never understand marriages like that. On some level, I do, because there's going to be points of contention with a marriage that just exists forever. I mean, it seems to be part of this sort of, like, you know, that's what makes a marriage al dente. You know what I mean? Like, you got to have a little of that. You know, I've never understood, you know, couples that are just complacent and seem to be happy with each other, you know, no matter what, you know?
Yeah, it's great that I could come on this morning and help ruin a marriage.
Oh, I think the way to do it would just be to start to move things around. And where'd I put that thing? Like, I don't know. You know, that to me would be the way to slowly drive somebody crazy and effectively. But, you know, I'm sure that, it must be just crazy for her to live in that. Anyways, Carol in Long Island, a different one. All right. How are you, Carol? What do you got on your mind? What do you have to confess?
Well, I'm so glad you do these confessions, because we need them. And we liberals who are secular Jews also don't have a good confessional place. But I feel like I have something like a political mood disorder, and I'm feeling terribly guilty.
Yeah.
Because the whole tsunami thing, I feel bombarded by. I feel terrible with that, and then I feel numb to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading the New York Times News of the Week in Review, and I'm looking at their predictions for a few days after, when we see which faction will control the whole region. And I'm just feeling just out of it. You know, there's a guy I met in Italy this summer who just died, and I'm feeling so mournful because I knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I don't care about these people, and it's not that it's even a racial issue.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel bombarded. I feel so caring about the whole thing, like the election, and then I go through, not even cynicism, but like numbness, like I can't take it.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, there's something that comes with, you know, like there's a moment of anger, and then there's a weird tolerance we get into, and then we go into this sort of like a guilty kind of paralysis, which feels like apathy. But I think that what you're experiencing is probably, you know, perfectly normal. I mean, it doesn't. The confession is not. You're just feeling a little numb because you're overwhelmed, right?
Right.
Well, have you taken any action to aid the tsunami victims at all?
No, I will, but I'm even watching to see which place I should give aid to. Like, which is the corrupt place where the aid is never going to get through?
Oh, I know, you know, but you're going to make yourself crazy. I mean, on some level, I mean, I think
I'm going to give aid.
Well, I think that the penance is just to, you know, just to make a decision, you know, donate what you need to donate, you know, and at least feel that you've taken that kind of action. I mean, you can always break things down until, you know, nothing, you know, is worth doing because everything's so corrupt, that I would just take the action.
I think I have to volunteer for something where there is a constant flow of people who believe in something and they don't. And they really kind of can feed that.
Well, now I'm feeling guilty.
Paid for that.
Now I need to do more. you just transferred your guilt onto me, Carol. I know how you
very
go.
Effective,
I know how this
Carol.
Works.
Very good.
All right, I
well,
get
you're
it.
Jewish, and I'm Jewish.
I know. I know. So now, all right. So now you should feel better for at least a day.
Okay.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was too much. She's like, maybe I should go down and help. And I'm like, yeah, maybe I should too. Oh, my God, I need to do more. She got me. See, that's how it works. That was right. What you just experienced right there was a Jewish marriage.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's a very
just
short
guilt,
one.
Just moving the guilt around.
Unbelievable.
Circle,
unbelievable.
Circuit.
My the woman I'm married to now is not Jewish, and she doesn't do that. She blames me for everything.
even if it's clear that there's no way to really map out, there's no, you know, logical evidence or circumstantial evidence that I had anything to do with what's my fault, it's going to come around
but
to being my fault.
Guilt is not that, you know, I grew up in Berkeley, California, which is a guilt.
They manufacture it there, don't they?
No.
It's guilt-free?
Well, it's guilt-free in terms of when you're a kid growing up, you can do anything you want.
Yeah, like, yeah, you're a free spirit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Please don't be judgmental.
Wow. So that you grew up with this whole non-judgment thing, but I have to assume, like, I'm still fascinated with the idea that your mother's got to be a little judgmental.
Well, I'll find out.
Yeah, you will?
Yeah.
All right. So we've got some exciting things coming up. I'm looking forward to talking to this guy, John Howard Kuntzwer. I believe his website is kuntzwer.org. That's spelled KUNSTLER.org. Because I can't even say the name of his manifesto, you know, on the air. It's a cluster manifesto. And, you know, this guy is one of these guys that, you know, that is out there in the world writing, you know, who, you know, he snapped at some point. I'm not sure, you know, his background is, he's a lawyer?
Well, he's part of this whole sort of new urbanist movement of people looking at, you know, where society is going and how we're going to be living in cities.
It's pretty interesting stuff because, you know, the basis of his argument is that, you know, pretty soon, you know, oil will become so expensive and such a depleted resource that it will just cost too much to transport food and goods very long distances. So we will be back in the small town mode of local economies, local farms, and it's fairly idyllic, but what has to happen in order to get there is kind of rough.
Cataclysmic.
And we're also going to talk about those 10 war profiteers. We've got a few more of those to do after this.
The Rose Gallery.
With Anthony Wappe, 58 past the hour, Air America Radio.
On Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Mark Maron here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes. Everybody who's listening, welcome aboard. It's nice to have you. Mark Riley will be returning tomorrow morning from his trip to England, where he, I hope, brings back many tales and exciting stories. You know, Riley, it's gonna be nice to have old Riley back, isn't it, Kalo?
Yeah.
My guest host today, before I introduce my guest host again for the third hour, I want to welcome our newest affiliate, KAQQ 1280 AM in Spokane, Washington. Good morning to you. Pleasure to be on board out there, where we will be running in, you know, we're on air live now, and I think they're going to repeat us again at 6 o'clock their time. If you want to help the victims of the tsunami in Asia, go to the links page on morningsedition.com to see what you can do. There will also be a rally to support the Challenge of Florida and Ohio Electors tonight in San Francisco. To find information about that, www.redefeatbush.com for more information. I, Mark Maron, will be performing at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater in Davis Square, Somerville, Massachusetts, on Friday and Saturday, January 21st and 22nd. You can go to www.jtoffbroadway.com for info and tickets. I'm laughing at myself because I'm drinking soda and I feel
tingly.
You know, it's something's coming. You know, I don't want to do it on mic. That voice is the voice of my guest host today, Anthony Wappe from the Guerrilla News Network, GNN.TV. Let's tell, it's got a lot of different listeners now, Anthony. Tell, give people a little summary of what GNN does.
Well, GNN is an online-based web community that's both a news, independent news source, as well as a production company. We do independent documentaries, feature films, probably best known for the music video we did for Eminem called Mosh. And we also wrote a book that came out a couple months ago called True Lies. That's a real investigation into a lot of stories that the mainstream media has missed.
And you are, you know, they will be premiering a new video soon with another big name who hasn't been around in a while. Can't tip it more than that, but it's going to be good, so stay tuned at GNN TV. We are GNN.TV. We are counting down the top 10 biggest war profiteers of 2004 from the Center for Corporate Responsibility. We've gotten through 10. We've gotten through 3. We had number 10, Qualcomm. Number 9, Laurel Satellite. Number 8, Lockheed. And now we're at number 7, Anthony.
One, you may probably all, you know a little bit about. This just goes to show you how sketchy these companies are, that
Halliburton
is coming in at 7.
Halliburton's number 7, and that is the one that everybody used to symbolically demonize the entire war contracting industry, is number 7.
Well, credit, Halliburton has...
There's no credit to be given.
Has got the most money out of any of these companies. They've gotten an estimated $18 billion. This is in terms of the Iraq reconstruction bids. Where do you start, really, with Halliburton? You have a Department of Justice, a criminal investigation into Halliburton that they've gouged taxpayers for $61 million worth of gasoline
that
they were charging the military. You have audits looking into their books that found that they couldn't justify $1.8 billion out of $4.3 billion. Or about 43% of bills under
they couldn't justify
$1.8 billion.
How baffling is that? That this administration pledges $350 million to the tsunami, which that's money. But I mean, when you hear about when you talk about the numbers that these contractors throw around now, if they are the ones that receive the most money, Anthony, why are they number 7?
Well, this is a list put together by the Center for Corporate Responsibility. I think, when we start going up the list here, some of these other companies were really quite blatant and were really involved in some sketchy stuff.
All right, number 6, Custer Battles.
Custer Battles is actually a really small company that was doing a lot of security work that was basically setting up sham corporations in Lebanon, the Cayman Islands, and were just sort of blatantly, according to many reports, ripping off the government.
Funneling money right out of our government.
Yeah. The next one at number 5, CACI and Titan.
Khaki? Is that khaki?
Yeah, they picked a great...
Don't they call themselves that, though, khaki?
I think they do,
that's a government... it's a security contractor,
I mean, this is interesting because this ties back to our guest from the last segment.
Mm-hmm.
The Titan had guys inside Abu Ghraib, and many people believe they were responsible for at least taking part in a lot of the torture and abuse that went on. Now, the interesting thing is these guys, because of the laws that Bremer basically handed the interim Iraqi government literally on his way out to the airport, they're totally unaccountable. Because they're not U.S. military personnel, they're not accountable under military law, and because of, I think it's order number 39 that Bremer handed down to the Iraqis, these guys can't be tried for their crimes in Iraq.
Beautiful. But a lot of people assume that they planned it that way.
Well, it sounds like it to me.
Right, that they said, we can't, if these guys aren't part of the military, they can do whatever the hell they want
right.
to. And they can even blame them and it won't make any difference.
Right. Coming in at number 4 is BKSH and Associates, a consulting firm and sort of a PR firm that worked with Ahmed Chalabi. You haven't heard his name in a while. He's sort of low profile.
Were they the ones that they put out the Let's Have Fun in Iraq brochure?
I'm not sure what exactly they were involved in terms of promoting him, but they were really behind the Iraqi National Congress. They were, some of the people who marketed Chalabi as the George Washington of Iraq. And how well that worked out.
Put the Chalabi on the $1 bill in the Iraq campaign.
Yeah, I think he was on the $3 bill.
Yeah. Okay. So number 3
is Bechtel, which I have to say
they've been around a long time.
Yeah, Bechtel is old school company. They had they sort of split up the deal with Halliburton.
Right.
Halliburton was doing a lot of the big contracts to help support the troops. Bechtel was theoretically supposed to rebuild the water system, the electricity, all that stuff. Basically, they got none of that done. They didn't finish any of their contracts. I have to say, I'm a little sympathetic to Bechtel in the sense that the conditions were so hard over there that, they were trying to rebuild water systems while, basically a war is going on.
So they still haven't finished this stuff?
They
pulled out?
Yeah, I mean, that's one. They've shut down a lot of the major operations.
To continue at a different date?
Yeah, when the war's over.
Mark, it's you know, aren't there elections at the end of the month? Isn't
That's right. I forget. Everything's going to be fine there in just a few weeks.
The water's going to be run. I mean, this is one of the big myths that, you know, the administration has been perpetrating. If you talk to anyone in Iraq, which I do often, that they say that, the electricity is back on to pre-war levels and the water is running.
It's very erratic, correct?
The electricity is completely erratic. The water systems, people are, you know, getting hepatitis C and D and E.
Really?
You know, in some of the slum areas of Baghdad, because the running water is and part of that is because the Americans in places like Fallujah are carpet bombing the place. But,
so the water supply becomes corrupted.
Yeah.
And it's never. Oh, that's just awful.
Yeah.
I had no idea about the hepatitis of.
Oh
the,
yeah, no, it's horrible.
So number two, Bearing Point.
Yeah, Bearing Point got and this is, you know, peanuts really. Mm-hmm. It's only $240 million. To help develop Iraq's competitive private sector. Essentially, they got a contract, which they actually wrote the contract that they got,
mm-hmm.
To help basically privatize everything across the board. One of the things that the Americans did, one of the things that Bremer handed the Iraqis on his way out the door,
right.
was we're going to privatize everything, turn over everything to anyone who wants to come in and invest and take over.
Get your chunk of Iraq now.
Yeah, exactly.
Step right up. We got contracts, and you give us some money.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll come back with the number.
Number one.
Let's come back with it.
Everyone's on the edge of their seat.
Yeah, and also we'll take some calls as well. If you'd like, 866-303-2270. We'll come back with the number one top 10 war profiteers of 2004. We'll also take some calls if you'd like to pipe into this conversation or talk about whatever's on your mind with Anthony LaPay. We will be back after this. It's 15 past the hour on Air America Radio. Past the hour, Mark Maron here on Morning Sedition. My guest host is Anthony LaPay from GNN, Guerrilla News Network. That's GNN.tv. If you're curious, we're taking calls at 866-303-2270. I'm going to do this palm pile, which came in from Ramon earlier, wearing a navy blazer and boxer shorts. This is Tom DeLay's palm pilot for today. Here's DeLay's schedule. 8 a.m., wake up. First day of congressional session. Roll over in bed and wake up lobbyists for the tobacco, military, pharmaceutical, and oil industries and make them breakfast. 9 a.m., buy newspaper. If the guy at the newsstand smiles and says, good morning, accuse him of conducting a vicious partisan witch hunt. 11 a.m., rezone voting districts in Texas so the map looks like me on horseback. There you go. 11:30 a.m., obtain morning pardon for afternoon misdeeds. Note, repeat as necessary. 1 p.m., during roll call, when Democrats say here, accuse them of conducting a vicious partisan witch hunt. 3 p.m., call President Bush, assure him that his mandate should last 3, maybe even 4 hours. 4:30 p.m., obtain afternoon pardon for morning misdeeds. Note, repeat as necessary. 7 p.m., go to kitchen for snack. If empty, accuse refrigerator of conducting a vicious partisan witch hunt.
There you go. To live by.
Yeah, vicious partisan witch hunt. So we're down to number one, are we not?
This is exciting.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I'm looking for my drum roll. Here we go. The number one war profiteering big corporate offender is...
Aegis. You have never heard of this company. They probably would like it that way. This Aegis Defense Services is basically a mercenary firm that started about 2 years ago.
Okay.
By a guy named Tim Spicer. Spicer is a super controversial guy. He's basically been fighting private wars for unscrupulous dictators around the world. In 1997, he put down a rebellion by the government of Papua New Guinea to crush the popular uprising from people who had basically, you know, rose up against this corrupt government there. He's been investigated all over the world for illegal arms smuggling. He's not listed as one of the State Department's sort of okayed private security firms. Somehow, not only did this guy get a $293 million contract to provide security services, he basically was the hub that was orchestrating all of the private security firms under him.
So private security firms being a sort of is a broad term for perhaps, you know, obviously mercenary armies.
Basically, the Iraq War has become a full employment program for all the former South African mercenaries and UK mercenaries who've been fighting these private wars, who were hunting down Nelson Mandela's people, you know, in South Africa. I actually drove from Baghdad to Amman with a ex-South African commando who was telling me how excited he was about the growth possibilities in Iraq.
For mercenary armies.
Mercenaries, yeah.
Now, mercenaries have been around since the beginning of warfare.
Yeah.
On some level.
Yeah.
But they don't seem to call them what they, you know, it's very misleading labeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of how the American administration handles that.
They are actually the third biggest, if you count all the private contractors, mercenaries together, they're the third biggest military force in Iraq right now.
Uh-huh.
There's about probably 20 to 30,000 of them operating. Bremer's private security is being run by a group called, used to be run by a group called Blackwater, and when those guys were killed in Fallujah, it spurred the first and failed invasion of Fallujah when they were strung up. So they've been integral to the whole process of in Iraq. We couldn't really be fighting it without it, according to the U.S.
Well, they're probably much more better equipped than our nation's armed forces,
right,
given that they've been shortchanged.
Our special forces guys are really spread thin across the globe, so
right,
we need to bring in these specialists, you could argue. The problem is they've basically been ripping off us off like the rest of these companies.
Well, I just think it's a shame that, you know, it's not an argument to bring them in, it's just an argument that if we are indeed supposed to have the greatest fighting force on the earth, that, you know, there should never be an argument about, you know, whether or not they are, you know, prepared or armed properly, which there is. Let's take a couple of calls. I just lost my call sheet here on my computer. Who's number one there, Chris? Joe. How you doing, Joe? Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
How are you? Listening to LIB in New Jersey, right?
I am indeed.
Okay, what's on your mind, Joe?
Well, I just think we shouldn't be too quick to let Bechtel off the hook. In fact, I would hold them more accountable rather than less. There was a window of opportunity in the spring and summer of 2003 before the insurgency started blowing things up, where Bechtel came in and hit the ground walking backwards. I remember the article, there was like a cover story in Newsweek sometime in the summer of 2003 about the state of the reconstruction and how very little had been done. And in it, they talked about how some of the electrical plants had either no visits or only one visit from Bechtel. And Bechtel's concern wasn't, their first priority wasn't getting things back online, but taking out the asbestos they found in the plant.
Right. Joe, I think you make a great point. I wasn't trying to let them off the hook. I was just saying in the scheme, I've been dealing with them over the last couple of years, talking to them. I got the sense from them that it was more of a case of ineptness, like you're talking about, than some of the more criminal operations that were going on at some of these other firms. But you make a great point.
And it's really sad because, you know, that was the chance we had to convince them convince the Iraqis that, we could come in and make a positive change after we had, you know, bombed the hell out of them. So.
Well,
that's
thanks.
All I had to say.
All right. Well, thanks for your call. So, what he's saying is that these companies never, you know, really intended to fully, you know, finish what they were doing. It was sort of like, let's just get what we can when we can and get out.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's lots of different ways you can look at it. I just personally had a little bit more faith that Bechtel was at least on the ground trying to do, some of the projects that they were. That they were trying to, you know, they had been tasked with doing.
Right.
Whereas some of these other companies in the Center for Corporate Responsibility's list here were literally criminal operations who were ripping us off left and right.
Why do they exist if everyone knows? Well, that's a stupid question. Why is the American government the way it is right now? Why do any of these businesses? They figure out a way to get around things.
Yeah.
You know, with their money, with lawyers, and with everything else, is that, you know, they're criminals, you know, to us, but to some people, they're great free market entrepreneurial companies.
Right. And he brings up a great point, though, about Bechtel, because it was part of what we were really trying to sell to the Iraqi people was that we were going to get your water turned back on, we're going to get electricity back going, and we didn't. And that was part of the failure that unraveled into this basically a popular insurgency.
Which is why so many new members of the insurgents are just, pissed off Iraqis.
Yep.
Okay, we are going to come back with John Howard Kunzler, who's going to discuss, peak oil and what happens when the oil runs out. He's the author of The Geography of Nowhere. We'll have that, The Liberal Agenda, more of me and Anthony after this. It's 28 past the hour, Air America Radio.
On Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Mark Maron here. Morning Sedition is the show. Mark Riley back tomorrow from England after... How long have you been away? Like a year, Kalo?
A couple of weeks.
Now, let's be honest. Like, what's it been, a month and a half?
About, yeah.
Like 6 months, maybe? I mean, I'm losing sense of time. Oh, my God. In the co-host seat today, Anthony LaPay from Guerrilla News Network, GNN.TV, also the co-author of True Lies, which is sort of a big batch of stories that you may not know about. Correct?
That's what it is.
Now, our guest, I'm very interested. You know, apparently, I gave his website wrong before, which is why I'm not supposed to give out websites. But you can go to his website, vis-a-vis morningsedition.com. He has something on there called the Cluster Manifesto. And also, he is the author. He talks about suburbia and also about the running out of oil. He's the author of The Geography of Nowhere, Home from Nowhere. He has a book coming out this year from the Atlantic Monthly Press, The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. I can feel an upbeat, enlightening conversation coming on. Please welcome to the show, James Howard Kunzler. Good morning, sir.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
I'm pretty good, Jim.
How are you?
It's nice to
I've been
here.
Looking forward to talking with you. I saw you in this amazing documentary called The End of Suburbia, which, sort of breaks down what's going to happen when the oil starts getting too expensive and how our society is going to change. Can you just explain, what is it? There's a lot of misconceptions about the idea of what peak oil is. What is peak oil?
Boy, there are a lot of misconceptions. It's really the point where the world is halfway through its total endowment of oil.
Are we there?
We're very close. It also means something else. It means the point at which we will be producing the most oil that we will ever produce and no more. And from that point over the peak, we will incrementally produce a percentage less oil every year.
And the other important thing to remember, too, right, is that the rest of that oil on the back end of that curve is getting harder and harder to get out of the ground, right?
Exactly. It's in the most forbidding places in the Arctic, and it's in places where the people don't like us very much. And it's the oil that's very expensive to get out of the ground. In fact, some of that remaining half of the world's total oil is stuff that will never get out of the ground because it will take more than the equivalent of a barrel of oil of energy to get a barrel of oil out of the ground.
So you're saying that peak oil then, once we hit that level, we're really, far beyond halfway done on some level.
It's a very significant point. It's also the point at which the demand line on the graph crosses the supply line.
Okay.
And so it's the point at which a lot of systems that our advanced civilizations rely upon start to wobble and have trouble.
All right, so what are the repercussions, political and economic, that will result once we hit this point?
Well, one is that we will never again see the kind of industrial growth that we've been accustomed to.
Okay.
Or the growth that will occur in some places, perhaps like China, will occur at the expense of other places like the United States. It has tremendous implications for the U.S. because we have built a living arrangement, which we commonly refer to as suburbia, that relies on absolutely dependable supplies of cheap oil.
In terms of people having to drive everywhere and getting goods and services into what some people call hell.
Yeah, basically this drive-in utopia that we created for ourselves, and You know, I refer to it in a lot of different ways, but I think the most significant way to describe the American suburbs is the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world.
But have you seen some of those condos?
Huh?
Have you seen some of those condos?
Well, I've seen millions of condos.
It's all the same, right?
You only really need to see one, right?
That's not the problem. Yeah. The problem is not that it's all the same, because there are a lot of things in this world that are all the same. You know, the boulevards of Paris are very hard to tell apart.
Right.
The hill towns of Tuscany are very similar.
But what you're seeing there
are uniformities of excellence.
Right.
And what you're seeing in the American everyday environment are uniformly miserable environments that are horrible to be in, and moreover, places that have no future.
They have no integrity, no authenticity. They are constructs built to just funnel money out of the middle class through.
Yeah, well, I think that's a legitimate way of looking at it.
Okay.
Then now, you know, we can criticize it all day long because,
sure,
you know, apart from the fact that it's, it's got a short horizon.
Well, that's optimistic to me. I mean, that's very exciting.
Yeah, well, it is.
Well, that's because we're all liberal elitists.
It's going to, you know, the cratering of this tremendous infrastructure for daily life
is
going to cause us huge political and social problems.
Okay.
There's going to be tremendous turbulence around the failure of suburbia, which also includes, by the way, the loss of a tremendous amount of hallucinated wealth.
Okay. You mean credit wealth?
No, I mean just the belief that these things have value.
Oh, interesting.
The realty.
So, like, paint a picture for us, Jeremiah, as to, you know, tell us some of the apocalyptic, what is the apocalypse of suburbia look
like?
This
isn't really apocalypse. This is,
the crumbling.
A significant transition in the history of civilization.
Well, list some of the elements of the crumbling of suburbia.
I think we'll see an orgy of repossession.
Okay.
And as people desperately try to unload suburban properties that are quickly becoming useless.
Okay.
And undesirable.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we'll see a tremendous amount of anger on the part of middle class Americans who have lost their entitlements to what's called the American dream.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this anger will translate into a lot of political mischief.
Mm-hmm.
And that we will waste a lot of our time and spiritual energy trying to defend and sustain the unsustainable.
Oh, yeah. So now that you have phrased this as a transition,
yeah,
what are we transitioning into?
Well, I just don't like the term apocalypse.
Well, I wasn't using it that seriously.
I'm not a religious nut waiting for the rapture.
No, I wasn't using it in that way. I was just trying to paint a picture. But I understand your definition as well. But now, if you call it a transition, you know, what are we transitioning into?
Here's the deal.
Okay.
Circumstances are going to compel us to live differently, and what that means is we are going to have to downscale all of the activities of American life. We're going to have to make them smaller, better, more compact. We're going to have to return to the traditional living arrangement of towns and villages and neighborhoods.
But, Jim, isn't this sort of, I mean, this is almost a quasi-utopian idea. I mean, what you're talking about, all these things sound good to me, you know, living in smaller,
well,
more compact communities.
Well, yeah, they sound good, but they probably would be an improvement, but what you have to take into account is that the messiness of this transition is going to be tremendously disorderly. It's going to be accompanied by a lot of, financial ruin and a lot of political violence
and abandoned gated communities, apparently.
Well, you know, I think you'll see a lot of suburban property of all types and kinds lose its value.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to have to downscale this country, and we're going to have to change some of our many of our activities, such as, for example, agriculture.
Right.
You know, the end of cheap oil and cheap natural gas and the interruption of the supplies of them is going to spell the end of farming with huge, quote, inputs of, you know, artificial fertilizers and pesticides.
Fertilizers are made from petroleum as well, right?
Most of them are made from natural gas.
Right. So you're saying that along with the crumbling of suburbia and this horrendous transition we're going to take, we're going to get better cheese and milk.
Well, it might take a while, but you could draw that conclusion. Let me just finish this thought.
Okay. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
You know, we're going to have tremendous problems with food production as the, you know, great ConAgra, Archer Daniel Midland, cheese doodle and Pepsi form of agriculture fades into the past.
Yeah.
And one of the things it means is that the successful places in America are going to be the places where you can grow food locally,
right.
Or at least some or part of your food supply locally. Now, that has tremendous implications for some regions of the country. You know, there are places like Phoenix and Las Vegas, which have been the model for hyper growth, you know, in the late 20th century, early 21st century. And they're held up as the models of the way we should do things. You know, those places, in my opinion, are going to dry up and blow away.
I want to talk to you a little bit about your interpretation of Vegas, because I read that on The Sea of Nowhere, his new book coming out from the Atlantic Monthly Press, Along Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century, I assume will be out soon. It is 44 past the hour. We'll be back with him in a second here on Air America Radio.
Check out all our favorite links, our latest blog entries, and our new line of merchandise at morningsedition.com.
All right, let's land this thing. It's 50 past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning's Edition. My guest host all day has been Anthony LaPay from GNN, Guerrilla News Network, GNN.TV, also the co-author of True Lies, a book available at our website at morningsedition.com, along with a link to our guest's website. Our guest is Jim Kuntzler. He's the author of Geography of Nowhere, Home from Nowhere, and The City in Mind. We are talking about the collapse of suburbia. We are talking about peak oil. We are talking about Las Vegas when we left before the break as being the example of everything that's wrong with America. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. How do you describe Vegas?
Well, it really represents something fundamentally wrong with our thinking processes that's occurred in the last 20 years or so. And it's the idea, which is now really taken as normal by most of the American population, that it's possible to get something for nothing.
Right.
You know, a very, very dangerous idea for a society to subscribe to.
That's replaced the American dream on some level.
It's the place where the American dream crawled off to die.
Okay.
And, you know, when we start having serious problems with our fossil fuel supply, the excitement in Las Vegas will be over.
What about the alternatives, Jim? I mean, you know, I understand what you're saying, and it all makes good sense, and in the sense it has to happen. But a lot of people are hedging their bets on alternative fuel sources. Anything?
Yeah, this is what I call the Jiminy Cricket syndrome.
Okay.
If you wish upon a star, your dreams will come true. You know, this is actually related to the idea that it's possible to get something for nothing. We've become a very wishful and kind of infantile people through the last, you know, 20, 30 years. We've really had it rather easy. And the truth is, no combination of alternative fuels will allow us to run what we're currently running in the United States, or even a substantial fraction of it. Part two, there isn't going to be a hydrogen economy.
Okay.
It's a fantasy, and it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
We're simply going to have to live with less energy, and it's going to be a tremendous problem for us.
Go ahead.
You know what's interesting? There was this great article in the New York Times Magazine recently about how actually New York City was one of the most fuel-efficient cities in America. Did you see that?
I did. And it was.
What did you think about that?
Well, it was interesting, but I think it was somewhat misconceived. Yes, New York City is very fuel efficient if you're living in a cheap fuel economy.
Yeah,
you know, but it does raise the question, and this is something I'm very concerned about, is what is the destiny of our industrial megacities?
Okay.
Especially the ones that are composed of skyscrapers. And there aren't too many of those. You know, New York, Chicago, and the list in America kind of ends there.
Well, wouldn't the destiny be the same as our industrial manufacturing cities that are all dead now?
Well, I think the destiny is going to be a little bit different for New York, but it's still going to be very difficult because here's the deal. All of our big cities are going to have to contract. They're going to have to get smaller.
Mm-hmm.
They will continue to be there. They occupy very important geographical sites. But they're going to have to get smaller, and the process is going to be very painful, possibly kind of ugly, as this contraction occurs. It has already occurred in several of our biggest cities, or many of them, in fact. You go to Cleveland, Detroit, St. Louis, Kansas City. These cities are really, for all practical purposes, they're dead.
Yes, right.
You know, and they're now surrounded by a suburban hinterland whose days are numbered. So this whole process is very problematical for America.
Okay, so now you said something in your manifesto about, it was sort of at the end, and I wanted you to go into it a little more about the sort of the end of elitism.
Oh, gosh. Well, in that essay,
mm-hmm.
I was kind of describing the changes that this country is going to go through, and I think you actually misinterpreted it. In point of fact, I think that we will be entering a very different social arrangement of
right.
things, and it will tend to be more hierarchical rather than less hierarchical. It will tend to be less egalitarian rather than more egalitarian. For example, one of the things that's going to happen in this country is that we're going to have a lot more agricultural labor performed by human beings. This implies that there will be a pretty large class, or at least a larger class, of people who work on farms
mm-hmm.
than there has been in the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this also implies very different social relations between the people who own the land and the people who work on the land.
Mm-hmm.
I hasten to add that we're going to have tremendous problems simply reallocating our land for more intensive agriculture. So, no, I don't think that we're going to see the end of elitism by any chance. What we're going to see the end of is people saying that there's something necessarily terrible about elitism.
Right. We got to go, Jim. You know, it's certainly great talking to you. And The Geography of Nowhere is available. Home from Nowhere is available. The new book, The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century. When's that going to be available?
Coming out in May this year from the Atlantic Monthly Press.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. Hope to talk to you again.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Okay, take care. You can also link to his site on our site at morningsedition.com. Very interesting guy. Very interesting guy.
Yeah, really fascinating. You can also see him in this documentary called The End of Suburbia. That's where I first got turned on to Jim there. You can find that at endofsuburbia.com.
Okay. According to the New York Times, some of the people planning Bush and Cheney's inauguration have received, quote, a hot off the presses 2005 Dick Cheney calendars, a limited edition that features 11 months of the vice president fishing, riding a horse, giving speeches, and walking with Mr. Bush along the White House colonnade. The 12th month December is a photograph of Mr. Cheney's Labrador retriever. End quote. Well, look, we did a little investigative work and found out about some of the photos that didn't make the calendar. For January, there was Cheney flashing his pierced nipple during the Super Bowl halftime show. For February, there was Cheney's open heart surgery in honor of Valentine's Day. Kind of grisly, but, you know, interesting. For April, we have Cheney with a Abu Ghraib prisoner wearing a hood with a propeller on top. April Fools! For June, Cheney throwing rice at his daughter Mary's lesbian wedding. Aww. For July, Cheney and Halliburton executives dressed as the founding fathers ripping up the Constitution. Boy, these guys are funny. For October, Cheney's dressed in scary Halloween costume. He's wearing a blue suit, red tie, and aviator glasses. All right. For November, Cheney as 80-foot-long Macy's Thanksgiving parade balloon. And for December, Cheney as innkeeper evicting Mary, Joseph, and Jesus from the manger. There you go. There's the liberal agenda. Anthony, thank you for being with us. Anthony LaPay, GNN.TV. The book is True Lies, available on morningsedition.com. Here are your marching orders for today. One, to protest FCC organized alternate Super Bowl halftime show produced by Larry Flint. Hello. Two, work with AARP to recruit Canadian drug mules to smuggle low-cost prescription drugs across the border. There's a job for a retired person. Three, work with designers to make fake fur jackets look faker.
1994, proposed new liberal constitutional amendment, the right to keep and bear a grudge. today's phrase dropped into the conversation, Bush and Clinton working together. The dominoes are falling, man. One party, one religion, one mind. Get fitted for your uniform, sheeple. Wake up. Thanks again, Anthony. It was having you here. Tomorrow, Mark Riley is back, so you come back too. Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.